Let me just get the ball rolling with the comments and maybe a few questions. First, the comments is on my own chapter. I was interested that you described it, I think it's Marco who did it, as a critical chapter. On such was not my intention. I saw that I was categorized in that way in the volume, but I think it's really interesting because it was not my purpose. I think I just stopped at the threshold of vocabulary, and I had no idea how to use the words matter, on material, on all those all this lexicon. And then I decided, I mean, the term material, the distinction between matter and form was perplexing me. And that's all I did. And actually, basically at the same time, I published a book in France about the constitution, in which I defend the idea of a material constitution. I guess that the origin of the misunderstanding is the fact that in France, mostly, and to my understanding in Italy, but maybe I'm wrong about Italy, is that in France, at least, material constitution means constitutional topics, constitutional subject matters that are not entrenched in the formal constitution. For instance, electoral law. Principles about electoral law are few and far between in the constitution. But basically, most of electoral law is outside the constitution. So, as people rightly or wrongly acknowledge that it is important to the constitution to know how people who govern us are being elected, we call that a material constitution. And I guess that was the reflex that triggered me to ask the question of the relationship between matter and form in constitutional law. And I just started from that point on. My chapter does not reflect negatively on the idea of material constitution, which in fact I adhere to. Maybe not in your own way. I'm interested in what you say and your neo-Marxist approach to the whole thing. But so there you go. I think really at the crossroads between the view I supported in the chapter on your own general idea, which probably I misunderstood in the first place, or maybe I did not just take it on board sufficiently to do something that was on the mainstream of the book. My question remains, in what sense is the material constitution a constitution? Why don't you say, for instance, there are social forces, there are economic structures, ways in which society evolves, or ways in which some economic forces try to shape social life, and they have an influence, or they have some sort of structural relationship with the constitution. Where is the cement? So how do you cement the idea of those material forces, whatever you put in the basket that you call material? What is exactly your reason to call that the constitution, to call that a constitution? So that would be my first question, and it's probably the question that has stopped me on the threshold of going on board with you guys. My second question would be, why is it in your view that so many core social or economic values or institutions or even norms are not in the entrenched constitution? I mean, why is it? Probably there are some counterexamples. I haven't read all the chapters about other jurisdictions that I know nothing about. But if you take, for instance, France, or say the U.S. in many regards, labor law. You talked about the central bank's monetary policy. It's absolutely not in the written constitution. There's nothing to say in the constitution. Maybe there is a golden rule in Germany, but it's not very frequent that you see in constitutions references to what generally you guys are calling the immaterial constitution. On that, that's a genuine question. In this very room, a year ago, we had Paul Kahn, and we discussed about life and death and sacrifice and everything that Paul does. My question for him was, why do you think it's the case that nowhere in Western constitution it is said explicitly people may be required to die for the state. Why is it that constitution don't say those things? Do you have a view?
What was his answer?
His answer was, I don't know.
Okay.
Basically, he had never thought of it. My third and last question, which is just really very close to the first one, would there be a new view prospectively if you were constitutional drafters and if you would like to take that job, even intellectually, would there be in your view a more adequate way to attune the formal constitution lawyers? Constitutional law of lawyers, to attune it to the material constitution. Would there be a better way to draft constitution, a better way, I don't know, to do judicial review, for instance? If you could just prescribe new ways of attuning the material constitution to the formal constitution, how would you do it? Or is it just so foreign to your whole approach that you just don't want to answer the question, which would be fine?
Do you want to go?
Shall we answer?
Yes.
Shall we try to leave an answer to all three?
Sure.
I mean, again, I think there is definitely a tradition, as we are saying in Italy and France, of talking about something that is materially constitutional, although it has not been recognized formally. But there is also a tradition, at least this is clearly in Germany and in Italy, and in Spain as well, actually, of literally thinking about the fact that there is something about constitutional law that is core or fundamental.
Mm-hmm.
And we are actually speaking to that tradition
more.
Rather, although I don't think it is completely relevant what you were mentioning. And I mean, the case that I made of the central banks and monetary policies are actually a good case. I mean, monetary policies today are clearly, materially speaking, for constitutional relevance. But they're also fundamental. They're fundamental for the organization of society.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you change monetary policies today and you change fundamental social relations. That's something. While if you change the electoral law, I'm not so sure you change also fundamental social relations. But if you change money and the way money works, this has an impact on basically the financialization of society. Direct impact. So you see a change in pensions, works, social security, you will see a change in family rules, and so they have a cascade effect. It would be the equivalent of when you abolish slavery. You know? It has an impact on the labor market, but it has an impact on a lot of things as well. In a way that the electoral law, as important as it is, I don't think it has. I mean, it is strategically important, and if you want to come to your third question, you might want to think about it strategically, but it doesn't really generate societal reorganization in itself. I mean, it's just a means that might conduce to other political struggles to do other things. But that's, in my view, it's... And the reason why we call it constitution is, first of all, because we want to tap into this British tradition, which used to call that type of constitutional order the material constitution, but you could call it the constitutional order, or the core of the constitutional order.
Right. So you're going that far.
Yeah.
Okay.
You could call it the core of the constitutional
order.
This is how I would say. I mean, there's something fundamental about this. It's something really fundamental. And it has to be, and this is a crucial point, strictly connected to the organization of society. That's the wider existence of relations of production and reproduction.
I'm glad I asked.
So it goes as far and as deep as that. And that's why, so just to give another background to this, this is also, it's a bit of a kind of a Commonwealth type of thing. In the Commonwealth, there's been, for 20 years, as you clearly are aware, a massive debate between supporters of a legal conception of the constitution and a political conception of the constitution. And one of the things that if you come from a more materialist perspective, you find a bit frustrating about that debate is that there is clearly no material underpinnings to it. So they seem to question things like what should be the last answer to all constitutional questions, not should it be a political answer, should it be a legal answer. as if they were kind of metaphysical questions, and with no really material reflection.
Yeah, maybe let me just add something about the second question. I think you asked three. Why are so many constitutional norms not in the entrenched constitution, as you put it, or the written constitution, or why are there so many constitutional silences, which I think is a nice term to capture that. And not only constitutional silences, but also topics on which so much constitutional scholarship remains mute. There is a certain, now I'm using Lachlan's terms after having critiqued him in the first part, there is a certain prudential logic in not writing too much in the Constitution, and maybe even in not writing anything in the Constitution, if we want to take it to the limit example of a fully unwritten Constitution. And that might be because it's possible that within a certain set of ordering forces, political unity, institutional balance, social relations and political objectives, a fully parliamentary regime could sustain that order, for example. But that would be tied up with a very particular way of governing and with a set of very concrete historical circumstances that enable the regime to be governed in that way, which is full of constitutional silences. But of course it's not absent of constitutional norms in some broad sense, in fact in some material sense. And it's interesting to track, for example, in the UK, how EU membership was tied up with a certain change in the material constitution, tied up with a certain capitalist modernization, for example. So I think that there is some prudential reasons for those who are in a position to maintain a system, not to include too much in a system. A scholar once referred to the civilizing power of hypocrisy. And I think there is something to that. But there's also something to the fact that what is included in a constitution, and of course now we have to think about also the institutional ways in which that constitution is protected, empowers certain organs, such as constitutional courts, which over time come to be the dominant constitutional interpreter, even if they were not intended as such at the origin. And we can think even of the most classic case of the US Supreme Court as an example. And that, I think, then also enables me to say a little bit about your third question, which is, what would we prescribe in a constitution? And personally, I would prescribe very little. I would, or at least to put it differently, I'd have a very cautionary approach to constitutionalizing particular domains. But it's not intended as a normative project in that sense, as you rightly identified, but more about the logic of power relations, which is another reason, of course, why institutions tend to become more and more self-empowered. So if you think, for example, about the European Court of Justice, I'm looking at Jakob here, who's writing a thesis on the way that the European Court of Justice develops a certain systemic power based on what is not even a constitution, at least in its original terms, but which the court turns into a constitution of sorts, without getting into debates about whether the European Union is really a constitution based on a constitution or not. But I think we can see in that logic of the the self-empowering tendency, the tendency of institutions to self-aggrandize. No one's helping me out with this terrible word. I'm pretty sure I didn't just invent, but
you have your ED here, I think.
So in your first question is the most difficult one to answer. In what sense is the material constitution the constitution? And Marco answered it, which is to say that it's the material constitution of society. But I suppose what you want to know is,
where to look for the material that is significant enough to be considered constitutional. I mean, that's perhaps the way I would interpret your question. But I would say, just to finish my observation on that, I think the formal constitution gives us certain clues as to where to look. So in a sense, we're not blind in this map. We want to look beneath the formal constitution, but that's not to say that the formal constitution is irrelevant. And in terms of the constitutional mapping, I think that an obvious starting point for a lawyer is the written text. But as long as that isn't the end point of the inquiry. And that's why also history gives us certain clues, including formal constitutional clues, which is why I think the debates in the interwar period were so significant, because what was previously a constitutional silence, in this case the social question, the question of inequality, the question of industrial relations, the question of labour law, becomes a constitutional question in the context of concrete political struggles. So we can find clues in history, in historical reconstruction of constitutional change, but I don't think that there is a knockout answer, as it were, which is why we also need some degree of specificity in our contextualization of the constitution, of the particular material constitution, both in terms of the time and place. So yes, it changes over time, and also changes in accordance with jurisdiction. But there is also some logics which are nevertheless general, or at least general enough for us to say something more about the dynamics involved, which is why I use, or I suggested, capitalism and democracy as heuristic devices to give some more overview of the kind of dynamics that constitutional change reflect.
Thank you, that's very enlightening. Other questions? Jean?
Maybe I haven't read the book, and I read your paper, essentially. So I might show more ignorance than anything else. But coming back to the question that Denis asked earlier, I come back to this because I had the same confusion initially, but because reading about the material constitution is what in substance relates to the relationship between institutions of the state or the state and citizens, and not the way you understand it. And I read from your article, to understand these phenomena requires attention to the underlying material context, to the basic political and social conditions of possibility of constitutionalism. And you define the constitution or constitution law as, or what, rather the material constitution as the core of constitutional law. And then you gave the example of what fundamentally changes social relations, if I heard you well. And you gave the example of money. And then reading your paper, listening to you, it seems to me that the core of constitutional law seems to always to be the defining economic component, something that relates to, you know, the organization of the systems of production. And so my naive question is, isn't the material constitution in the capitalist society always the same? It's hidden under the formal constitution, is not the real operative one. The material constitution is what, if I understand well, is what provides the dynamic within society, and the real constitutional actors are, for instance, as you gave examples of international banking institutions. And so, doesn't defining the material constitution always end up giving the same answer?
Maybe you know, if I can start answering this, and the central bank case is I think a classic case of this. If you had asked me this 100 years ago, 150 years ago, the answer to Libera is not the crucial institutions. If you look at the history of Federal Reserve and central banking, for example, in the US, you clearly get a sense that there, this was at best a cycle struggle, but until the rise of the dollar as the international currency, the Federal Reserve never had and never was taken for granted. You had, I mean, Jackson abolished it.
Yeah, yes, I understand.
So, but this was, so if this was a possibility, it meant that it was not part, in my view, of the fundamental structures of the organization of the U.S. society. In a way in which today, you have been to abolish the Federal Reserve. I don't think it would even be conceivable. You might want to reform the Federal Reserve. But the imagination that the U.S. go back to free banking today, with the role of the dollar domestically, and externally, is just not even imaginable. Is this written somewhere in both statutes or written constitution? No. But is this core constitutional concept? Most likely, yes. And why? Because that's not the same modern political economy in the U.S. that used to be in the 19th century. So there has been changes.
Yes.
Right?
My question was, are there actors other than, because now you have the Federal Reserve, it played a role now that didn't play 100 years ago, but 100 years ago we had other economic actors that were as important. But what's the place of non-economic actors in your understanding of the material constitution? That's rather my question.
Now, this is a big one in my view, and I can only provide a tentative answer, which is going to be disappointing. And maybe Mike wants to jump in or try, but clearly we don't want to say that all constitutional relations are caused by underlying economic relations, because this would be self-defeating. Because if the starting point is that we don't want to conceive the constitutional order as something external to society, mm-hmm. but it has to be internal to society, so it's part of societal organization, then obviously all the metaphors of, which probably we wrote there too quickly, of being underlining or being hidden, it's just, you know, it's just a system that you have to hold together. So my feeling is that there are important material forces at work, but that's not everything. It's not everything because, I mean, just to give you an historical explanation, and which is far from being sufficient here, so this is clearly needs more work, but it's not that a material constitution is a perfect achievement, right? It's a regime which contains certain contradictions, for sure, gaps and stuff like this. At a certain point, some of these things become ungovernable. Now, how do you intervene and you make up for something that addresses those crises? Well, that's clearly, it's partially materially determined, but it's also partially a work of the imagination.
Mm-hmm.
So there is still a level of political freedom, which in our view, clearly, is what is played out in sites of struggle. And that's why I would be very cautious, as Mike was saying, in saying, this is how you should write your constitution. Because, I mean, that's really, epistemically speaking, need to ask the people who are in the struggle,
mm-hmm.
And so this, I guess, is only a partial answer. But what I want really to make clear is that we don't subscribe to a vulgar Marxist type
deterministic
that you have, like, first you have economic relations, and then this causes a superstructure.
Mm-hmm.
Which is basically just, you know, the emanation of what is underlying. No, what you have here is that societal differentiation, as we insist on saying, so secularization, but also science, technology, politics, political economy, law, and these things have to be held together. And that's the real challenge. You know? And it happens in contemporary societies at the level of reaching a certain level of political that is possible only if you organize core social relations, because otherwise it collapses.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So thanks, Marco. Marcus, I mean, more or less covered it. But I think you could. I think there's a way in which we can answer the question as both. So if the question is the constitution of a capitalist society always the same? The answer is yes and no. So if we use the four layers of the material constitution as outlined in the article, political unity, institutions, social relations, and political objectives, these obviously change over time in significant ways. They are relatively autonomous in that sense. Marco used the example of the recent significance of banks, central banks, and financial institutions. We could think about, for example, the ebbs and flows of political parties in terms of their ability to mediate between state and society, trade unions change over time. The political form itself may change. Perhaps this is something that we haven't gone into, but someone earlier mentioned the theory of the federation, which we have a chapter on the book by Signe Larsson, who talks about how the federation is a distinct political form. We might think about if the EU is properly characterized as a federation, how within the European space there is a chain in political form from the nation state to the member state of the federation. We think about the changing role of imperialism. So in that sense, which is crucial to mapping constitutional law, then absolutely the answer is no, that it's not the same. It's not always the same. It changes over time in quite distinct ways. And we might here recall the significance of democracy as a way of pushing change in certain directions, which is why I linked it to the relative autonomy of the political, that there is space for change even within the confines of a broadly capitalist system. But here we get, I suppose, to the flip side, which is that I do think there is a certain logic that does remain the same, the logic of competition, of accumulation, of commodification, which persists throughout these various changes, and which in that sense is part of the material constitution understood over the long durée of the modern capitalist state. So that's why I frustratingly would want to say yes and no, but it does, I don't know if this is a cop-out, depend upon the degree of abstraction which you're tackling the object of the material constitution.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting because I come from Canada, a federation, and a federation that would build up to achieve economic ends that could not be provided for under the old system of colonies independent of one another.
Right.
And
right.
So the form changed, but the driving force was still the same, in a sense. The institutions might have changed, but the objective was still promoting capitalism, and that was the driving force.
Yeah, yeah. So are they fundamentally driven by a material logic? Then quite probably.
Mm-hmm.
But within that, there is still some degree of relative
latitude.
Thanks.
Right, the floor is now open if you have questions.
Thank you for your presentation. I'm going to ask a question, but I fortunately haven't had any chance to read your book, and I'm afraid I'm going to project a little of what I know about Professor Lodge's project and the idea of political constitutionalism. So if it's not accurate, just correct me.
More publicity for nothing.
Maybe you're familiar with the detail of our famous Persian poet Rumi that talks about an elephant that your fortune is art. And so I'm gonna try to relate it to my own project, which is thinking about the role of public law and constitutional lawyers in today's political regime of my country, which was my great question, that what am I doing in public law, studying public law on your own? That's a great question. And which led me to read about a little about the philosophy of human sciences and the differentiation, the distinction that also has associated itself with legal positivism. And what I detect in this, in trying to, you know, understand the map of, you know, legal theories in today's Europe, is that whereas we had a movement of differentiation between human sciences, we now have this movement of, you know, converging. And if I understand it well, Ian, your idea also, and this return to an Aristotelian sense of constitution and of the legal constitution, constitutional organization, political organization of society, destroys this barrier between law and politics, and then politics and economy. And so I was wondering what do you think is the mission, is the job of the constitutional lawyer now? So when Professor Barringer asked you, what is your consequences? And I also wrote that in the conclusion of my dissertation and Professor Wagling's idea of the constitution, that all is well, but now what do we do? What do you do in judicial review? What is the, when a constitutionalist is asked a question, at the end, I still think a little positivistically that law is a normative domain. You know, we cannot just stop at description. So what do you think is the role of constitutional law? Because this here is, you know, a scientific political analysis of the constitution of society. I would have done the same by just pushing more representation of disenfranchised classes in, you know, the representation, political representation. Why do you need to critique the concept of constitutionalism? Because historically, constitutionalism was just a barrier to tyranny and arbitrary rule. So you can still use that. You can still use the spirit of constitutionalism. I don't think the problem is formalism. Per se, the problem is that your side or my side is not the one who is, you know, who's producing these norms. I don't know if I'm clear.
Yeah, you are.
the spirit of constitutionalism as a barrier to arbitrary rule. So I suppose I wanted to treat your question as a provocation, in a way. As to whether this project, diverse as it is, means an abandonment of a certain attachment to liberal constitutionalism, where that means some constraints on arbitrary power. I suppose my first slightly quick answer would be that if we're relying on lawyers, we've already probably lost the battle. But that may be too quick. In terms of the attempt through constitutional law to restrain arbitrary powers, I would probably think that the history of constitutional law shows that it was rather unsuccessful. Does that mean that we give up on the notion of holding people to account? No, of course not. But this is where I suppose my political constitutionalism would come back in. To the extent that we can restrain the exercise of arbitrary power, it will be through politics, through democratic politics, through processes of mediation. That will involve, in part, legal mechanisms. But to have a faith in the law alone, or constitutional law, or constitutional lawyers to do that job, seems to me totally misplaced. And to the extent that we want, for example, to curb the power of unelected institutions such as banks and financial markets, that will require political movement, it will require political change, it will require democratic parties as well as material movements. So in a sense, yes, of course, who is not in favour of constraining arbitrary power? But if we want to take seriously the full measure of arbitrary power in a society, we need to look at private power. We need to look at domination in all of its manifestations. And therefore, we need the material constitution.
Because how do you track domination if you don't have an understanding of the material constitution? It remains a formalistic enterprise in my view of domination, where the main targets are, as it was, legal versus political constitutionalism. The main targets are things like courts at the best, where, I mean, they're growing in importance, but let's be honest, that's not the main problem, by far. So, I think that's, I mean, I think the role is very limited, as Mike was saying, and my view is you want to think strategically about the role of lawyers. Still, my suggestion is that track reality properly, because otherwise you might end up with conspiracy theories or forms of escapism, and which means defeat. I mean, but if you want to act properly, you need to know basically what are you facing, because otherwise it's quixotic, you see the point. I mean, so there's a sense, I mean, this is an invitation to basically fundamentally political realism, no? But it's like you need to assess, no? What is the reality. It doesn't mean that you, for example, start by saying capitalism is everything and we are powerless. That's not what we are saying. I mean, there is constant insistence about the fact that there are sides of struggle, no? And that's why there is hegemonic attempts to try to hold control over these sides of struggle. But you need to know, no? What is the balance of forces? What are the points of valorization? What are the weak points? I mean, this also, you need legal assessments. That's, in my view, the role of lawyers. But then you need social forces.
Yeah, I mean, between, you know, the institution of a judge, wasn't the point, the attraction of having the judges in the first place, in the, you know, the first established modern society, we go back to ancient time, is exact precisely that they are not political militants. You have to go back to that. Even we isn't the whole point of a constitutional lawyer is that he or she gives you the correct answer to terminate the case for now.
Yes, but you know, I mean, if you're talking about constitutional questions,
you are talking about unity, and you know, the work of a constitutional judge or a judge, administrative judge, is to, you know, keep the order, and it's the job of the politics to be in movement, and so it's the dialectic of the two.
Hmm.
I'm afraid your version destroys law in favor of politics, and so I was thinking it would be more balanced of the two. The lawyer, the constitutional law, needs to be separated from constitutional politics.
Whatever, that's
I mean, I'd put it slightly differently. I would say in order to have something like independent judiciary, you need strong political institutions.
Mm-hmm.
I would exactly reverse it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Sure.
I have a bit of a selfish question, because it's really for my own understanding of sort of this project, because I didn't have a chance to look at the book yet. I think in the early 20th century, Charles Beard wrote this book called The Economic Interpretation of the American Constitution. And would you say that he gives sort of a material account?
We have a chapter on it.
You have a chapter on it, okay.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not entirely satisfying, but we have a chapter. It's a good chapter, but it's all.
Be careful,
Marco.
Be careful.
Yeah.
All the chances are highly successful.
This we cut. This we cut it. I didn't want to say that. I mean, it covers a bit of ground as well.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, what we were saying?
Well, I mean, that was my question, because that makes a lot of sense. Yeah.
Yes, I think it's an interesting book. It is a bit poor in terms of explanatory power, because it really goes back to the personal interest of the founding fathers.
Mm-hmm.
So it makes it the case that what was really the material factor, the main material factor behind the writing of the US Constitution, was the personal interest of some of the people who were writing it. Which, fair enough, it might have been relevant, but I mean, this is not really the material constitution.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we are talking about social forces. So it's not because you have your personally owned slaves that that's sort of the question of why did they reach a compromise. And
you were also talking about these wider disputes between landowners and industrialists, and
yes.
How those compromises were ratified in the text. So that's the kind of things you suggest we look at.
Well, definitely this is helpful to my view. It definitely helpful. I mean, but not as personal personal dispute, but as widely organized your political economy on the compromise between the value of land and the value of industry.
Mm-hmm.
This is the imagination, constitutional imagination that moves that compromise, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which serves because you want to create political. How do you get political unity? The political economies of the southern states is so quite different from the political economy of the northern states.
Yeah.
You need a point of convergence,
mm-hmm.
Which is not a rule of recognition, not a convention. It's not that the northerners didn't know how to clue why are we converging on this text and why are we agreeing on creating a federation.
Mm-hmm.
There were reasons. There were not conventions.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It was a project with divisions, which exploded later. When it became unsustainable, it explored it.
Yeah. I mean, this is why state theory, in a broader sense, is more important, because it's not that there is a simple translation of the interests of individual capitalists into the various other branches of the material constitution. I mean, that could plausibly be the case in some instance, but
well, if you think of countries such as Hungary or maybe contemporary Russia. You do see.
But I think there you can see certain trends in terms of the changing composition of certain social classes, which helps to explain the attachment to certain constitutional norms and the desire to change. You mentioned it, but I think that from what I understand, at least with the Beard analysis, is that it's two reductions in terms of trying to orchestrate the coordinate between particular interests and the general interest, where the material constitution is an attempt to transcend those various interests of particular capitalists.
Mm-hmm.
But it may contingently be the case that those links are more direct in some instances than others. I mean, they're more primitive and more advanced forms of capitalism. I mean, this also maybe to some extent, I'll come back to your question, but there is some context in which feudal relation, or pre-modern relation, is still extremely entrenched in the regime, in which case a relatively modest political change may require a very dramatic material intervention.
Mm-hmm.
Think about, for example, the universal suffrage. Rights for men and women. Those battles, which I call the battles for sort of bourgeois form of equality, are not over. I mean, so that's where there is an interlinkage of these stages. In fact, you can't even really talk about stages in any simplistic sense. But it does mean that we have to be attuned to the particular constitutional context.
Mm-hmm.
Where the independence of the judiciary might be a straightforward idea in one context, but in another context might
here maybe this example of the Lochner era is also quite instructive, right? Where the independence of judiciary was a means to prevent all this progressive legislation from being up to the point where Roosevelt threatened to expand sort of the composition of the court.
Court packing.
Yeah.
Well, I fully subscribe, but not for different reasons, to Ackerman's view that the New Deal was a new constitutional regime.
But in a material sense, he would say.
Because, you know, if you look at what they've changed, banking, labor relations, these are really social security. Of course, it doesn't mean that it is entirely different. It's not a total revolution, but it's definitely a different political economy, which comes in reaction to disastrous economic crisis. I think Ackerman would strongly disagree with the fact that this was determined by struggles around the material organization of society. He said that this was one of the factors that would probably make it more of a history of political determinism of Roosevelt and the organization of the Democratic Party. But that's based on the constitutional theory.
I also have a question. Thank you for your presentations. I'm not sure I completely understood what is the material constitution in your opening book, because I understood it was a core. So there was this idea of unity, a core, and there was also the idea of a tool of understanding, of comprehension, and also the idea that some people would see the material constitution as a goal, as an endpoint, and you said it was not irrelevant, but it shouldn't be an endpoint, a goal. And also we spoke about some manifestation of the material constitution, like the spirit of the constitution and also of the political parties. And what I was wondering is then what aspect of the material constitution is in question? What is the part that is critiqued? What is the part that would be illegitimate? Is it the concept in itself as a tool of comprehension, or is it the goal, the end point that the material constitution, whether it is social, political, or economical, would be a goal, a focus that we should go towards? And that's the point I don't understand, because if it's a goal, then we should go towards this goal. So I don't understand what is the point that is critiqued.
It might be necessary there just to clear up something, because we might have been talking about goals in different ways. So there, of course, there are the objectives of the constitutional order, which one may want to critique. One may want to suggest alternative goals. Those precise goals are also to some extent contingent, and I think I said minimally the goal would be the preservation of the order itself. But as the state becomes more advanced, it might adopt more elaborate goals to do with a certain level of welfare of the population. So we can think about the welfare state as implying a political objective which goes beyond mere survival. So the goal in the sense of the political objective of the constitutional order is descriptive. It's an attempt to understand the way that order moves towards a certain end. And that end may be explicit, as in the case, for example, where the preamble to the treaty tells us that there should be an ever closer union among the peoples of Europe, to take a slightly contested goal, to say the least. Or it might be implicit, that there are goals amongst certain institutions to pursue certain aims in relation to their status in society, or to their relative material strength and power in that society. There may even be implicit goals which become rhetorical goals, like the one I mentioned in relation to this, the euro, the importance of the single currency to the very project of integration. So in that sense, identifying goals is an analytical exercise.
Yeah, sure.
One which is you said, I think also to respond to Denny's original question, we get clues given not only in the constitutional text but also, and this is where law is important, in conflict. So there is a sort of a certain privileged position almost of the constitutional lawyer because they perceive the points of tension in that order. Again, I always use the Euro crisis because it was so prominent in my own education. But you can find this in context of emergency powers, context of state of exception that is raised in relation to terrorism or whatever it may be. These moments of conflict are highly illustrative because they shine a light through the various cracks of the material. So in that sense, it's analytical. So I'm not quite sure whether you were then asking what was our goal.
My question was not very clear, so I will just try to clarify a little bit. My question was, I understand that it is not the choice of goal that is the problem here and that it is predict, but I was wondering if then it is a material constitution as a tool to go to fill the gap that you were talking about earlier. So there is this unity that is kind of the goal, whatever the goal is, and then there is way to go towards this first mm-hmm. goal, and then is the material constitution a problem as a concept, or is it just critiqued because it is not very formal, or is it a problem because it is going toward some sort of unity, and then yeah, it would be like diversity is better, and we should not have unity, then we should not have government.
Right.
I'm just extrapolating.
Yes. Well, it's okay. So I think in our original article, we used political unity in a more kind of technical sense, not necessarily mapped onto political objectives, because political objectives could also be held by various institutions in society, various social classes in society. The concept of political unity is the starting point, and in some ways I think because when we speak about constitutions, we speak about the constitution of a political unity, of a polity. We talk about the constitution of France, or the constitution of Germany, or the constitution of China. So we, in a sense, we already have a political unity there of sorts, but it also struck me that unity is constantly in a capitalist society subject to contestation and struggle. That will be between capital and labour. It could also be between various regions within the polity. It could also be within an imperial organisation between core and periphery, and so on and so forth. So political unity itself is not easy to maintain. And that, for all the reasons that we then outlined in terms of the various conflicts that characterize social and political institutions, is there some way of transcending these various struggles in some sort of utopian future? Perhaps. But that's, in a sense, that's the part of the project, that's not really the point of this particular project, to outline a future material constitution that would solve these conflicts or resolve them once and for all. It's more analytical in that sense. But I would say that, and this is why I mentioned the rhetorical force of the concept, and you talked about a certain gap between the formal, or I think you asked us, what are we really critiquing?
Yeah.
And analytically, there is a critique of a way of looking at law, constitutional law, in disjunction from these material elements. But that's why I also wanted to move to a critique of a political jurisprudence, which goes, as I said, so far but not far enough in fully elucidating the terms that are necessary to fully elucidate the constitution as a whole. So it's primarily directed at that type of analytical critique rather than a normative project. But, and this is why I linked it back to the sort of unsatisfactory nature of the bourgeois revolution, is that there is in its historical trajectory a strong connection of the material constitution with an attempt to transcend the discrepancy in liberal society between formal and material inequality, formal equality and material inequality.
Okay.
So it's kind of this captures that the ideological dimension of the existing liberal order. And that, of course, is crucial to all sort of critical accounts of liberal constitutionalism, and not only in the Marxian tradition, but also in other traditions of, for example, a certain left republicanism, even a certain liberal. I'm thinking of someone like Judith Sklar, who is a liberal critique of rule of law legalism. So it can be connected to a variety of different normative projects, but there is an obvious rhetorical link with a certain connection to the productive forces of society, what keeps society going, but also what explains the conflicts that, as we see every day, society is ridden by.
Can I follow up on this? Because you both sort of connect this, at least the material constitution, to as a sort of alternative to the legal constitution, political constitution, as you have these debates in the UK, which are either sort of committed to legal constitutionalism, the rule of law, or political constitutionalism, committed to a democratic process. But then is there also, can there be something like a material constitutionalism? I think that's maybe a different way to ask the same question. And what would that mean?
You mean this is a way of being a normative spin?
I read Jacob's question slightly differently, as to whether there is a sort of materialist fallacy, or this is there's a potential to be too materialist a constitutionalist.
Well, I'm more interested like this because constitutionalism is obviously either ideology or sort of it has a sort of a normative. It's a normative project.
Yeah.
So can you have a material constitutionalism? So a normative project is oriented towards not the political process or the legal process.
I think so. At least, you might say even formally. So I think about the Italian Constitution of 1948, proclaims to be a constitution based on labour. And then a very interesting Marxist scholar, Amadeo Bodega, Bodega, pointed out, yes, it's built on the exploitation of labour. So the material constitutionalist, or an analyst of the material constitution, would say beware of false gods in that sense too, that merely by proclaiming the exploitation of labour had been overcome would not be to overcome the exploitation of labour.
Yeah, okay, but then it remains sort of a material critique more of constitutionalism than rather than anything else.
Precisely, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I mean, my impression is that, if I can jump in, this is just very out of my mind now, as I'm thinking about it, my impression is that it would be a form of political constitutionalism understood as against traditional political constitutionalism, the enlargement of political action to non-formally speaking political institutions.
Yeah, okay.
That would be, so with invitation, if it had to get, in my view, a normative spin, I basically think what Mike said in his presentation. I mean, fundamentally, to try to understand how you stage political conflict, democratic political conflict, outside formal political institutions. And that would be, in my view, simply an extension of what we call today. Today political constitutionism has become, strangely enough, mostly a project of empowering the executive power,
mm-hmm.
which is definitely what if you are if you do the critique of material constitution, it's definitely what you don't want.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want the empowerment of the executive. That's exactly what you don't want. But at the same time, you don't want just to play with empty figures like parliament. It doesn't make sense to talk about political constitutionalism if you don't analyze exactly what animates parliamentary conflicts.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That's what it is.
On this note, I think this is more or less all the time that we have. So I'd like to thank most warmly Mike and Marco for this wonderful book that we look forward to reading at greater length in the future, and for this seminar, which I think was very illuminating. So thank you so much.